take them to council. Your argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Parks will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. This court has granted application for writ of error on the question of whether or not an attorney can recover, or whether or not attorney fees can be recovered in the bill of review of a usury claim. The application also raised the issue of whether or not a statement of facts was late filed with the Court of Appeals, and that's a Rule 21C problem. It would seem most unfortunate that the posture of a case procedurally would determine the outcome of the case, and yet that's precisely what has happened in the Court of Civil Appeals opinion. The Court of Civil Appeals opinion states in effect that if you are in the posture of defending a bill of review in which the defendant claims usury, no attorney's fees may be recovered. I assume from the court's opinion that had the plaintiff in the bill of review been the one claiming usury, perhaps attorney's fees would have been awarded. This portion of the case, I think, is entirely a procedural matter because, as the court has stated in Baker versus Goldsmith, a bill of review is an independent, equitable action seeking to set aside a judgment which is no longer appealable or subject to motion for new trial. Independent of the substantive claim based upon some other statute, rule, or common law right, the bill of review has no purpose. I count it important that the bill of review procedure is called for in Rule 329B of the Rules of Civil Procedure. And I propose to the court that absent a substantive claim based upon some other rule of law, the bill of review serves no purpose. And for example, I'll refer the court back to its 1979 decision in Baker versus Goldsmith. There, the substantive claim had to do with a common law fraud. In a recent decision by the Court of Appeals here in Austin, which we'll discuss at length later, I hope, Rodriguez versus Holmstrom, the substantive claim was deceptive trade practice, Consumer Protection Act. In the Meese versus Murby case, the substantive claim is usury under Article 5069, 1.06.
Counsel, perhaps it would help if you refresh our memory just a little bit on the facts.
I'll be happy to. The case was originally tried in the county courts of law here in Travis County, whereby Mr. Murby made a claim for an air conditioning bill against Mr. Meese. Mr. Meese denied that he owed the claim, in effect stating that there was a corporation involved and he wasn't liable in the capacity in which he was sued, but in the event that he was, that he claimed that there was usury charged on this, what amounted to an open account. Mr. Murby made what I think this court would now call an unfortunate error in that he did charge interest on this matter, there being no contractual agreement to do so, and it was prior to the time that the statute was amended saying that you could charge interest beginning 30 days after the bill became due. So it became evident, and it was uncontroverted in the testimony, that there was in fact a charge. Well, the trial court, after a verdict, in effect saying that Mr. Meese was an agent for an undisclosed principal and therefore would have liability to Mr. Murby, the court went further and entered judgment for Mr. Meese, saying in effect that Mr. Meese's usury claim caused forfeiture of the indebtedness and then subjected Mr. Meese to penalties and attorney's fees. The judgment became final to the surprise of trial counsel for Mr. Murby, and a bill of review was filed. The case was tried in the bill of review on the two issues which the court set forth in Baker versus Goldsmith. One, that the judgment became final through no fault or negligence of the of Mr. Murby, and two, that he had a meritorious defense. The trial court denied the bill of review on the issue that there was no meritorious defense, that this was indeed usury, and that that was all that was required for the denial of the bill of review. The court made some incidental findings in its judgment that there was no negligence in failing to perfect the appeal or to do whatever should have been done to prevent the judgment from becoming final. In the judgment of the trial court, the holdings or the judgment stated that the bill of review is denied and attorney fees are awarded for preparation and trial of the bill of review and for appeal of the bill of review action. The Court of Appeals said, yes, it sure was usury, but we don't give attorney fees for bill of review actions because there's no authority, there's no statute, there's no contract. I think this particular statute, Article 5069-106, is probably the best possible statute for me to be arguing this case because it does not talk about presenting a claim. It does not talk about saying that the person having the claim shall do any particular thing. Article 2226, for example, states that a person having a claim for various things can, in fact, recover attorney's fees. This statute says that a person who charges interest in excess of double the amount of interest allowed by this subtitle shall, among other things, pay reasonable attorney's fees set by the court. It does not state that the person charging interest illegally shall pay attorney's fees for trial. It doesn't say that that person shall pay attorney fees for appeal. It doesn't say that that person will or will not pay attorney fees in case there is a bill of review action. It is absolutely silent on it. And so I think that this presents what has traditionally been the role of the courts to determine what is proper for attorney's fees when the authority is reasonable attorney fees. I don't need to refer the court to authority for the proposition that attorney's fees for trial would be proper under such statute, nor attorney fees for appeal. And I suggest to the court that a bill of review, as highlighted by this case, is certainly as necessary an action on the part of the person claiming usury as trial of the original case would be, as appeal of the original case would be, as appeal of the bill of review case would be. I think the problem that the Court of Appeals had is the long line of cases that saying absent a statute authorizing it or a contract to that effect, attorney fees cannot be awarded. And it failed to take note of the fact that a bill of review is not an independent action in the sense that it has a substantive claim attached to it. The bill of review has purpose and use only in light of the substantive law on which the bill of review is brought. In December of 1981, this same court, the Austin Court of Appeals, rendered its decision in Rodriguez versus Holmstrom, a bill of review case involving deceptive trade practice. In that case, judgment had been rendered in the trial court against Holmstrom. The judgment became final. A bill of review was filed by Holmstrom, and the trial court said that the bill of review should be granted. The appeal was taken by Rodriguez, and the Austin Court of Appeals said that the bill of review should have been denied because, as in this case, well, as in other cases which the court will be aware of, there was negligence on the part of the party that let the judgment become final. Then it did what I suppose is one of several options in handling the attorney fees questions on bills of review. It sent the case back to the trial court and said that attorney's fees for appeal of the original cause are the same as attorney's fees for appeal, well, are the same as attorney's fees for a bill of review, stating in effect that a bill of review, and stating this very explicitly, that a bill of review is like a writ of error, is like an appeal, and therefore attorney's fees for the trial, correction, attorney's fees for the appeal in the original action should be awarded. Now, it didn't say that it affirmed the attorney's fees in the original cause. It says it confirmed them. I think the court may have felt that it had some lack of authority, perhaps, to affirm the trial court's award of attorney's fees when that case was not in effect on appeal. Only the bill of review was on appeal. But I think that this attempt by the Austin court may be a later recognition of a problem of failure to award attorney's fees in a bill of review case. I think it is implicitly recognizing that attorney's fees in a bill of review case are proper, even if we have to call them an appeal. That presents the problem of the mechanism of how attorney's fees can be awarded in any cause of action, particularly a bill of review action. Since the International Security Life versus Spray case, the lawyers have gotten into the habit of anticipating what their attorney's fees should be, presenting evidence at the time of trial, and hoping that those attorney's fees that they testified to at the time of trial will in fact be adequate for the appeal of the case. The second mechanism whereby this might be accomplished is the mechanism suggested or ruled in the Rodriguez case, which I suppose is kind of an instruction to the clerk of the court in Hays County, saying that issue your writ of execution for the original, for the amount in the original judgment, plus attorney's fees, to include attorney's fees for appeal, because the bill of review is like an appeal. I suspect that the clerk down there is going to have a few misgivings about how far to go with the attorney's fee. Is a bill of review like an appeal to the Court of Civil Appeals, the Court of Appeals? Is it like an appeal to the Court of Appeals plus an application for writ of error? The exact relationship of those was not stated by the Austin court, and I think leaves something to be desired in instructing the clerk of the court on how to issue a writ of execution. Finally, the third mechanism for awarding attorney's fees in a bill of review action could be the one which is used in the federal courts, and that is simply to remand it to the trial court for findings by the trial court of what attorney's fees on appeal should have been or should be in light of the subsequent commitment of time. That is, the authority for that in a bill of review type case is Federal Rule 60B. And in the amicus brief delivered to the court, there is a case out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin, in which that is precisely what happened. The bill of review type action was presented to the court, and after denying the bill of review, there was an assessment of additional attorney's fees for the party claiming under USC 1983. There is one further point which I presented in the application for writ of error having to do with Rule 21C. The petitioner in the bill, the plaintiff in the bill of review, Mr. Murby, failed to file a statement of facts of the bill of review proceeding within the time required by the rule, and thereafter moved for leave to file that statement of facts. The reason given for the desire to file a statement of facts late according to paragraph 6 of the motion to extend the time for filing the statement of facts, is that Mr. Murby's counsel, and I quote, said, hold off transcribing the statement of facts. This was the direction that he gave to the court reporter. Well, after the time for filing had taken place, had passed, he discovered that this statement of facts would be necessary for any points of evidence raised on appeal. Otherwise, the court presumes that there is sufficient evidence to support the trial court's judgment. The Austin Court of Appeals permitted the late filing of that statement of facts. On behalf of Mr. Meese, I objected to that late filing or responded to the application. I also, on my motion for rehearing, said that it was improperly filed, and in my application for writ of error said that it should not have been. And I want to refer the court to its decision in Meshwork versus Meshwork, in which it stated that the requirements are that, one, you not intentionally fail to file it, and two, that it be that the failure to file be a result of inadvertence, mischance, or mistake. This is a case in which counsel for Mr. Murby failed to file it because he intended not to file it, because he said in his motion that he was not aware that it was required. So if this is in fact an error, it was an error not of mistake, mischance, or inadvertence, but it was an intentional decision on his part not to file it. Now, he may have been wrong as what the law was, but there's no question that he intentionally did not file that statement of facts. And so I ask this court to consider that the statement of facts should not have been filed and that there are no evidence questions before the court. With the court's permission, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You can reserve 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be
waiting. Your argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Dale Mueller will present argument from respondent.
May it please the pardon me. May it please the court. Counsel have the court change all of the prior case law relative to penal statutes. Counsel would have this court give a broad interpretation to Article 5096.1.06 relative to attorney's fees on usury claims. And looking at counsel's brief on this first point, carrying this from what I think is almost well, on one side, where he's up here asking for attorney's fees on a bill of review, a totally different lawsuit, totally different cause of action, totally different burden of proof. He's up here asking for attorney's fees on that. Let's go to the other side of it. His theory is that once you have been found guilty of having billed a man for interest inadvertently, which is usury, that you now become liable for attorney's fees. Now, he doesn't say where they end. He doesn't say what kind of a claim it's limited to. He just says, you read this statute and it says shall pay reasonable attorney fees as said by the court. And it doesn't say when it stops. It may be a little bit clear off to the other side, but I wonder if he'll be up here asking for attorney's fees out of some negligent action because the man had one time been found guilty of having imposed usurious interest on someone. This would be attorney's fees.
Counsel, what is the real difference between getting review by bill of review and appealing the original judgment?
Your Honor.
Practical effect.
Well, first of all, if you were granted a bill of review, you go back and bring it up on appeal, as I say it. you preserve, or you go back and set out your appellate point, your points that you would be coming up on. You have a burden of proving a meritorious defense. You do not, you lose any procedural errors. You don't have the benefits that you do normal, a regular appellate record. An instance of that is this, Your Honor. I think that in this case, this is most aptly pointed out by the special issues. They found that the real benefactor, the jury did, was not Nice, but it was a corporation that Nice was the undisclosed agent for. At the time, and that corporation was Austin Oaks Incorporated. At the time that this happened, had that been billed to Austin Oaks Incorporated, pursuant to Article 1302, 2.09, that would not have been usury. Now then, had we received notice that the judgment was entered so that we could take it up on a regular appeal, Frank Nice is an undisclosed agent. If he accepts the benefits, he would have the same responsibilities as the corporation. They were jointly and severally liable, therefore it would not have been usury. We lost that benefit, trying to get it in by a bill of review.
Well, let's take a hypothetical situation. Assume that the defendant is sued for usury without you. Of course, in this case, your client sued him, and he counteracted the usury. Let's say just a straight suit for usury.
All right.
And the defendant, if he loses, he's going to get stuck for attorney's fees, and the trial court can give him attorney's fees for trial, appellate court level, and on up to Supreme Court. Say he just sets back, say, I'm not going to, thanks for no thanks, I'm not going to participate. So judgment is entered, and then he filed his bill of review because he had not participated in the trial, he's entitled to file it. Would you say then that you could use that method and cut off award of any attorney's fees past trial court level?
Under the prior case law and under the way that I believe the statute is, I believe that could be used, as I attempted to point out and probably inaptly did it. The benefits of the appeal that you lose by going a bill of review route, I don't think a person's liable to lay in the bush, so to speak, and attempt to do this.
If he had no defense and knew it, he could maybe have some attorney fees.
Well, I'm not sure. I see what the court is getting at, but the other side of it is that Mr. Murphy's paying me, and I believe that his attorney would probably be getting paid, so he'd be spending his money. And really, rather than getting out of attorney's fees, I believe what you're talking about is putting the other counsel to work without compensating him. Because, as I see it, we aren't getting out of attorney's fees. Because my client is still paying me rather than paying both attorneys. On an appeal, we would have had the chance, and I believe a very excellent chance of reversing. But we don't have that chance under a bill of review. We can't come up with the same matters of law and the same procedural errors that we had on a, or would have had the opportunity to on an appeal.
What different questions are there?
Procedural questions that I don't believe that you can bring up on a bill of review, Your Honor. My understanding that you have to show a defense as a matter of law rather than
meritorious defense.
Meritorious defense. You do not have the right of procedural. At least I have not been able to find any cases that said that you did have a right to those. But looking at the statute upon which the petitioner here is relying, this court in 1967, speaking through
Counsel,
Justice...
I think most of us are right on what we think maybe the point is. Why did you not have a meritorious defense?
I think that we did, Your Honor. But they determined that we didn't.
Well, what was the defense?
Well, that the corporation was in fact the one that was liable because the undisclosed principal, who is claiming the benefit of the usury rather than the defendant, Mr. Meese was operating a set of apartments for Austin Oaks Incorporated. He operated it as if it were his own. He ran it. He made the phone calls. He called for the people to come repair the air conditioning. He left them the impression that he was the man that owned it. The lawsuit was filed against Mr. Meese and the apartments, but not the corporation that owned it. The day, or the morning of trial, I believe, and I may stand corrected on this, I did not try the lawsuit. There was an amended answer filed alleging he was not liable in the capacity in which he was sued and raising the issue of usury. Mr. Briley went ahead with the trial without asking for a continuance, and at that time found that it was Austin Oaks Incorporated that did own the apartments. The jury found that Austin Oaks Incorporated, or that Mr. Meeks was an undisclosed principal for Austin Oaks Incorporated.
Is not an undisclosed principal who purports to act, makes the contract, also liable?
Yes, sir. But my position on that is, Your Honor, that the jury in its findings that the corporation gained the benefit would have then said that they gained, under the theory that if they gained the benefit, they also gained the responsibility for paying for it, that the billing was in fact to the corporation, even though it was sent to Mr. Meese, their agent. And that the corporation could have been billed interest and not have been usury.
Who was the judge? You didn't get a judgment, though, did you?
We did not. No, sir. The trial court said that the claim for usury was valid, penalized us twice the amount of the interest in our $800 principal that the jury found for.
I was of the impression that not even a corporation could charge interest on an open account at that time.
I believe
that they whoever,
not,
huh?
I'm not going to argue with the court on the date of it, but I believe under...
I'm said counsel say this matter arose before the statute was amended.
I don't believe that it did. I did not have the opportunity, I won't say that I didn't have the opportunity. I cannot tell the court the date of that statute.
Well, in red, you were turned down, aren't you? Have appeal from that. So you've lost that, have you?
Yes, sir.
That's not even before.
That's why then we went on to the bill of review. And this is what I'm trying to get at is that the bill...
The claim from being denied being paid on the account is all as far as attorney fees?
Whether or not attorney fees are allowed on a bill of review under a statute...
I understand the statute.
...that this court has said on many occasions is penal and should be narrowly construed.
Talking about
2226. No, sir. I'm talking about
569-106.
Yes, sir. There is no claim here under 2226, contract or otherwise. So the only one that it could be is under the usury statute, and counsel would have this court extend that beyond, I think, any realms of reason. The Austin Court of Civil Appeals, I think, was proper in saying that there is no authority for it, and I think that the case is cited, and I would, with leave of the court, check that statute and apologize to the court if I'm incorrect on it. But I would think that counsel sets out in his brief several arguments that I'd like to just make basically one-line responses to. It says, denial of attorney's fees in this particular bill of review, had it been anticipated, would certainly have caused this petitioner to have a different attitude about his usury claim. The other side of that is, too, if the law had not been so firmly implanted that usury and attorney's fees are penalty-type statutes, very narrowly construed, my client might have said, well, we'll just pay it, even though we feel that we've got a meritorious defense. We may go ahead and pay it. It may be the smart thing to do. So if this court does decide that counsel is right, I think that this is a case that very definitely should not be reversed retroactively. I think that this is such a turnaround about penal statutes that it should not be retroactive. It should not apply to this case. Next, he says that attorney's fees are usually awarded to encourage small claimants to assert their claims. I agree with that, but likewise, attorney's fees are recovered because of statutory right. In summing up one paragraph, he says the better rule for this court to establish would be one permitting recovery of attorney's fees if the contest is about usury, regardless of what the name of the action is. There are two sides to that. One, I can't argue with him because I believe usury is illegal, but I think that that's a duty for the legislature. I don't believe it's something for this court. And I respectfully submit that the opinion of the Court of Civil Appeals of Austin should be upheld, and I do not believe that attorney's fees should be expanded or that the statute should be expanded at this time to include attorney's fees. I think that's for the legislature and not this court. Thank you.
Counsel, hear a rebuttal argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, at the time this cause of action arose, Article 5069 provided for attorney's fees on open accounts beginning January 1 of the year following the time in which the account became due. And that, I think my high school mathematics teacher would tell me that if you charge interest when none is permitted, you've got zero divided by whatever the interest rate is, and that's infinity. So we have, in fact, an infinite interest rate because no interest was chargeable. It's on that basis that the principal of the claim by the air conditioning man was forfeited, and that he was penalized twice the amount of the interest unlawfully charged and attorney's fees. Counsel has suggested that Article 5069 should be narrowly construed. I think the cases which have addressed this question have said strictly construed, and that may be a distinction without a difference. But I would like to suggest to the court that strictly construed does not mean a wholesale attempt to eliminate attorney's fees from plaintiff's claims or from usury claims. I think that what that language strictly construed means is that You don't go outside the statute to award attorney's fees. This particular statute does not give the court directions on what attorney's fees should be given for. It says reasonable attorney's fees. This court and the other courts of the state of Texas have stated that can be trial attorney's fees, it can be appeal attorney's fees. No exclusion anywhere in the statute for bill of review type actions. I suggest that the Austin Court of Appeals is correct in thinking that there should be some attorney fees awarded. Its trouble was finding the right mechanism to do it in the Rodriguez case. What caused the court to have its change of heart between October, when it rendered the decision in the Murphy versus Meese case, and December, when it rendered the Rodriguez versus Holmstrom decision, I do not know. I do not, after reading the briefs in the Rodriguez and Holmstrom case, have any idea how the issue which the Court of Appeals claimed was presented to it was in fact presented. In the Holmstrom decision, the court said that the issue was presented whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded in the original cause for bill of review. The original cause was not on appeal. The bill of review was on appeal. And the Court of Appeals did not take any action in the original cause. It simply confirmed the decision. I say that it is an admirable attempt on their part to decide that attorney's fees perhaps should be awarded for bill of review actions, but the mechanism of how to get there is a little bit uncertain. I don't think that a bill of review case is different significantly than the trial of a case after the threshold question is passed. That threshold question, according to Baker versus Goldsmith, is did the judgment become final because of fault or negligence of the complaining party? The trial court in the bill of review action, although I disagree with it, I think it's a question of a matter of law, the trial court in this case said, we find that counsel was not negligent in allowing the judgment to become final. That threshold question having passed, we are now at the proposition of what are the merits of the case, the meritorious defense. In Baker versus Goldsmith, the court stated that a prima facie proof of the meritorious defense is in effect adequate to shift the burden back to the party claiming, making the principal claim, to prove by preponderance of the evidence the merits of the case. There is nothing about the posture of this case that is different than the trial case once that threshold question is passed. We're still trying a usury case under Article 5069, and the question is whether or not this party committed usury. If the answer is yes, then there should be attorney's fees for trial and appeal of the bill of review case. It's the same lawsuit once the threshold question is passed. It is the position of this petitioner that the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the trial court award of attorney's fees should be affirmed. I think that is the simplest mechanism by which this can be accomplished. I think that it is also the traditional way that we attorneys have done this since the International Security Life versus Spray case in 1971. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
Johnny, please rise.